This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to The Line. We're coming to you live from Heritage Radio Studios in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm very excited to welcome my guest today, Andrew Tarlow. He owns and operates several businesses in Brooklyn, including Diner, Marlowe & Daughters, She-Wolf, Romans, Renard's, and the bar Achilles Heel. Many people have anointed him over the years in the press as being responsible for, as one of the people who's shaped Brooklyn dining over the past 15 or so years. When Diner opened in 1999, there was really nothing like it in that area of Williamsburg. That area was drastically different than it is today. He's opened up several other businesses, including a store that sells clothing wear and purses that is run by his wife.
That's right.
And Andrew, thank you and welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So let's start off childhood in Long Island. You're pretty close to the city. You became a painter and that kind of brought you over into the city. I'm curious, though, when did you really absolutely know that you wanted to try to make a life for yourself in New York City?
I would say the city continued to bring me back after university. So I would say, I guess in 95, I moved to Williamsburg. I think that's about the time. And I kind of like settled into that neighborhood and felt really inspired by like the desolation of it and also its proximity to New York City.
For those that weren't in Williamsburg in the early 90s, I mean, I kind of envision it as that's, you know, in Fight Club when he moves to that house that's in the middle of nowhere, he's hitting golf balls in the middle of the street. It's just, there was nothing going on,
nothing
right?
There.
So could you like stand in the middle of the street and in the middle of the night, there was no foot traffic, there was no bars in that area, right? So
yeah, there was basically no foot traffic. You could go to the waterfront. And you definitely could hit golf balls. That whole area on the waterfront was all abandoned. And we would drive down there and park cars and, like, just sit on the docks, like the beat-up old docks, all the time. There were trucks and cars. There definitely was prostitution. There was definitely, like, things happening. So some of the roads were definitely not, like, you could just stand in the middle.
Was it dirty romantic? Was it just kind of desolate? Like, what was the vibe back then?
It was kind of all of it. It was more desolate than romantic, probably. There were a couple bars, though. You know, there were some old school places that people had been drinking in. So there were some small little hubs for people.
So what exactly were you doing to make money then?
At that point, when I first moved there, I was doing everything, kind of odd jobs. I definitely was busing at a restaurant. I definitely was working on sets and, like, building sets. I would do, like, painting projects in people's apartments. I kind of just any odd job I could get.
So you were working at the Odeon?
At that point, I wasn't working at the Odeon. At that point, I was working at a restaurant on Park Avenue that doesn't exist anymore as a busboy. I didn't work in the Odeon until... maybe it was 95. You know, I probably have my dates wrong. I probably moved to Williamsburg in 93. I then went to Africa for a year and came back, and that's when I got the job at the Odeon.
What was the decision that you made in order to go to Africa, of all places that you could have traveled to? And you spent quite a long time there. Usually people go 6 weeks backpacking in Thailand. You spent a very long time there. How did that come about? What did it contribute to your ideas about what you later did?
I mean, it opened up my world in a huge way. I just didn't... it really, like, gave me the perspective to see how other people in the world live. In the end, I did think I was going to go for probably 6 weeks or 4 weeks. I ended up kind of getting stuck there. But also, it just... They didn't realize how slow or how long it would take to get anywhere. The transportation from, say, Eritrea, which is north of Ethiopia, down to South Africa was a pretty slow process. And so we ended up spending like a month in Ethiopia just not trying to go fast, but that sort of is the pace at which you can go, right? So the world really like unfolds in a different way out there. I would say, you know, it was a culminating moment for me. It definitely turned me into someone that I can think about other people versus thinking about myself and how do I take care of others in the world. I highly recommend it for any young person in the world.
Did you go to Africa to do anything in particular? Were you going as part of a...
No.
To paint, you know? There was no set goal in mind besides just traveling and seeing some of the world?
Yeah, it was more of an expedition. I definitely wanted to go... I definitely had this idea that I wanted to go in a very vague sense to sort of where the world began or the cradle of civilization idea. So being in Ethiopia and Eritrea was pretty important, being at that part of the Red Sea and all of that. But I probably wasn't as thoughtful as I probably should have been. I definitely was a little bit of a whim. I was living in a loft in Williamsburg. You definitely could roller skate and rollerblade all around that room. It was massive for very little money. And I had no really possessions or anything, so it was easy for me to sort of pack up and go at that point.
So you spend all that time and then you come back. Did you feel more focused or more lost upon your return?
I mean, I felt more focused that I wanted to stay in New York. I felt encouraged by what I had seen in the world, and I definitely felt inspired to kind of like do something for myself. I mean, the one thing about being out there for that long is it empowers you to sort of DIY for yourself, right? You realize like I can feed myself, I can get shelter for myself, I can take care of myself. So in the end, it allowed me to like break away from my family or for any of those things and be able to like work for myself. Well, not for myself just yet, but work and earn money and then be able to pay my own rent and pay my own way.
So you come back to the United States, you come back to New York. How do you connect with Mark Firth?
What a great question. So I met Mark Firth working at the Odeon. It was my first day there. And what was amazing about the Odeon at that very single moment is that Mark originally came from Africa. He had been living in Johannesburg. So we certainly had that huge connection instantly. And then also the general manager at the time was also from Zimbabwe. Now I'll tell you an insane story, this coincidence story that's insane, is that that night, my first night that I trailed there, there was a woman there that I met in Uganda. Okay? So when I was in Uganda, I was in Kampala for a day and a half. And I met the only other American that I met there was this woman. And she told me about a beach in Malawi that I need to go to, which I ended up spending a month and a half at. The first day I trailed at the Odeon, this woman was working there.
Unbelievable.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah. Well, so
and we had no connection to each other besides meeting for that day and a half, her telling me to go to Malawi. I hadn't seen her or talked to her at all, right? Just like...
And this is obviously well before social media, so it wasn't like you could reach out to each other and connect in any way. So you end up at the Odeon with quite a few people that have spent time in Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
Oddly,
so I felt home.
Oddly enough. So you're at home in New York. And Mark, you and Mark develop a good relationship with each other, and then you start dreaming up an idea together?
Yeah, so Mark and I became best friends and roommates. We took over a loft in Williamsburg on Broadway down the street from the diner. And that's where we sort of lived for two or three years before opening the diner, which was on the corner from where we were living.
And for people that don't know, Mark's M is the M in Marlowe.
That's right.
Cool. So... Yeah. How do you find the space besides it being geographically close to where you lived? Was it something that you walked by every day and sort of looked at and the gears started turning or?
I mean, it was a little bit more of a lark. Mark and I were looking for spaces in the city and there were other people that we were working with at the time that we were trying to partner with or thinking we would partner with. And for a long time we looked in the city, well, maybe say for a year we were thinking about doing it. And then... Really, at some point, I got into the old diner from the original landlord, and he showed around. I was like, we should just do it right here. Like, Even if nobody comes, it's like worth it just from the commute standpoint, just to do it right here.
When you thought about it in its original incarnation, was it always going to be a restaurant?
It was always going to be a restaurant, but we didn't have a chef until really the last 2 weeks before we opened or something like that, maybe 3 weeks.
So tell me about Caroline. How did that come to be?
So Caroline, we met through a mutual friend. I met her first and I kind of passed on her, and then we continued doing construction and building. And then we really didn't have anybody, and I said, Mark, we should meet this woman, Caroline. The three of us went out to dinner, and we all hit it off. And really, she's, you know, besides Mark, she definitely, and my wife, she definitely has been the biggest influence for our success up until now at that point. I mean, without having her in that kitchen, we would have been two total buffoons trying to, like, serve drinks.
So Caroline came from Savoy and from a pretty extensive cooking background, and she brought something to that restaurant that potentially wouldn't have been part of the discussion, right? So sourcing 100%. And maybe if you guys had the aesthetics and the bartending side, she was bringing a certain kitchen discipline to the table.
Totally. And also like big opinions about the way that food should look and taste on a daily basis.
Even though it's pretty obvious now to see the sourcing on a menu, it's sort of, for lack of, everybody does quote-unquote farm-to-table. Everyone's got a grass-fed burger. Many people say that they interact very closely with their farmers at every single price point of restaurants now.
Yeah. Sure.
But back then, your meat purchasing really set you on a different path in the restaurant. Can you talk about how that came to be and some of the partners that you've worked with over the years?
Sure. I mean, when we started sourcing vegetables and we were successful at that, we really started to kind of dissect where all of our food was coming from. And so we really wanted to, well, I was buying lambs and pigs for the kitchen to kind of keep them excited about what we were doing. And certainly they were excited. I think there was a moment there when, everyone was thinking about the whole animal a little bit, right? And so we really wanted to go find the cow and really figure out how does our meat come to our restaurant? So we went, and we also were really passionate about grass-fed animals. We really, or at least I fundamentally believe, it's one of the ways that we can really preserve our planet and take care of our planet and also take care of the health of the animal. So it's a huge, like, convergence of ideas. And we also live in the Northeast where there's plenty of grass. What did we do? My wife's dad went to a grass-fed conference. He met a man who owned a slaughterhouse in Pennsylvania. We went to that slaughterhouse, met him. He introduced us to a couple of, grass farmers who raise cows. We bought a cow that day, stuck it in the back of my trunk. We drove it back to New York. We used it. And then from that moment, you know, there were some interesting individuals in that car. Caroline was there. Tom Mylan was there. Sean Rembo was there. Dave Gould was there. Dave was the chef at Roman's. Sean just left the chef at Renard. Tom obviously was the owner of Meat Hook. And we bought that cow and then proceeded from there and tried to get rid of all commodity beef from the restaurant, which we obviously succeeded at, but it took a little while.
How apparent was it from opening day that you were going to do things differently at the restaurant, or did it evolve over time? Was there sort of, before you opened the doors, did the team decide that things would be sourced in a specific way, or did you kind of open with a more typical ethos and menu, and then it evolved maybe over the first couple months or the first year?
Yeah, the first menus, I mean, in the very beginning, nobody would even come to us for vegetables, right? So McCarran Park Farmers Market was just getting started. So the way we started buying vegetables directly from farmers is that we actually ran out of food on Friday night, and we'd have to go to McCarran Park on Saturday. It's kind of how it started. So it was really out of like a need and necessity in the beginning. But nobody would come to us at all, right? Like if we wanted Guy Jones, even people who we are super close to now, like wouldn't have come to Brooklyn at that point.
What was the What was the customer response? Were you, when you opened on the first day, crickets, 100-person line, overwhelmed? What was those first couple weeks like?
Well, we certainly were overwhelmed because we had no staff. So even if four people walked in, it would have been busy. That's for sure. The, you know, we got lucky in that there was a building, the Gretsch building across the street at that point was filled with artists and people living kind of illegally in artist lofts. So there wasn't a ton of kitchens there. And they really came down and really became our initial community very early on. And also some other buildings around us, which had similar situations. And in the end, what we realized by paying attention is that all these people didn't actually even know each other until we opened the restaurant and everyone can congregate there. So we realized what a meeting point diner or a restaurant really can be for a community. And that's kind of also been sort of the guiding principles of what we've been doing since then.
So in terms of diner starting, how did it grow? There's a spot next door.
Yeah.
And when did it open? And what was your comfort level like in expansion, going from diner to the space next door, which has a lot of similar characteristics, but does definitely function as an independent spot?
Yeah. You know, I had owned a Mexican restaurant before that. So I sort of at that point was feeling pretty ambitious about things. So I was feeling kind of ambitious. At the time for Merlot & Sons, it really, my wife just said to me, if you don't take it, you're going to be upset for the rest of your life by walking past it. So I was like, okay, you're right. And we really wanted to open a store. We really thought that the neighborhood really could use a organic store at the time. It's obviously pre-Whole Foods and pre-all that. And so the original conception was that we would open a meeting place that was a little bit more all day, where people could actually shop and eat and drink. So how do you make a place like the post office, the place that you have drinks at, the place that you buy your groceries at, and how does it like function on all those levels?
And it still to this day has a functional shop in front that sells goods and does coffee. And then obviously in back, you can drink and eat.
Yes.
When you did open the Mexican restaurant, which was in the spit, there were two, right? One was in Romans, or they were...
One was at Romans and one was on Bedford Avenue.
Can you talk a little bit about opening that? And then they both have closed. Well, one switched into Romans.
Yep.
How did that come to be?
Yeah, so let me tell you, So Bonita was a super successful restaurant for us, and it was really sad to close. We had lost our lease on Bedford Avenue, and we had been there for about 9 years, and I realized that the landlord had, that it wasn't worth pursuing, since the landlord really disliked me so much, or disliked us. And in the end, you know, we work in a space where we try to create relationship-based experiences, and it's like everyone else that I... do business with and or work with, you know, we always have a pleasant relationship. So I felt like it wasn't worth it. And once I lost the original, it felt kind of wrong to keep the new one open. So it was really more of like a change of direction than a place where it's like, wow, this is really not working. And the thing I actually miss the most, I miss that restaurant a lot. I talk about opening it again quite often.
I was going to ask you if you could open it again.
If I could open a taco stand right now, I would. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess I can do it, but you know.
Yeah, what exactly is stopping you besides that you're incredibly busy? Is it just if you found the right spot
and it spoke
to you, would you do a taco spot again?
I mean, if it was the right spot for that thing. Like, I don't want to own a full-on restaurant that tries to reinterpret Mexican food, like in terms of like all the components that people think of when they go eat in a Mexican restaurant, right? I definitely would like to open a place where you can get really good tacos. I think would be great.
Let me jump back to diner for 1 second and ask you about the menus. From the beginning, have there ever been printed menus, or has it always been the writing on the table and the verbal from the staff? I think it's a unique feature of the restaurant. For the most part, cannot think of another place that I've ever been, besides like a barbecue shop where they have like a menu written on the wall. But at diner.
Hey, you believe no one's copied that?
No one.
We've been
really
copied a lot, and that one's never been copied.
No one really verbals the menu. I know. Why did you start doing that? Has there ever been pushback to go to a printed menu there?
Oh yeah, definitely pushback. The thing is that I know this doesn't sound real, but it really was accidental. We were building the restaurant, and we didn't think about having menus. I tell that story often, and people call BS on it. Actually, you can curse here. But the truth is, we did opening day. We realized we didn't have a menu, so we actually just hand wrote the menu. And in the beginning, we didn't have a POS system either, so we would actually write the bill on the paper too. The idea was that
right on the table,
right on the table. Like we would be like, we would circle all the things that you had, and then write $4, $4, $4. But then we also realized that it was really trouble figuring out the tax on the fly.
You didn't want to have calculators at the table. It's a bit of a bummer at the end.
Seemed a little bit of a bummer. So, but that's what we, that is how it happened. And there's been some pushback from staff. Obviously, it has informed a lot of what we've done from a service standpoint and how we approach our guests. And it definitely has helped us kind of figure out who we are in the restaurant industry from that capacity. But yeah, we have played around with a brunch menu and a lunch menu a little bit, and then like sort of like a shorter bit to write on the table.
We're going to talk about staffing and also the way that you build your front of house and back of house teams. Mm-hmm. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. Stay with us here on The Line Heritage Radio.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Welcome back to The Line here on Heritage Radio. I'm joined by Andrew Tarlow, and I would love to ask you a couple questions about your staff, about the fabric of your restaurant. Yep. Since your staff is so vitally important, they're the communication tool to your diners, to your guests, what you would probably consider your family. I want to know, what do you look for when you hire? You've had incredible loyalty from your staff. You've had people that are with you for a very, very long time. What are some things that you look for and when you hire, and how do you work to retain your good people?
Great question. I think the company is built in a way that we are taking care of our employees. And I think that is strongly rooted in the culture of what we do. So in that capacity, I think that really allows for someone to have tenure. And there's also, we try and create growth possibilities inside of the business so that people can actually grow into new roles. So I think those are kind of some of the reasons for tenure. In terms of hiring people, I think the biggest hire I had, like we talked about earlier, was Caroline. So once I got Caroline, it was kind of easier to find great people since then. I think she becomes a magnet, not that she's with me anymore, but she became a magnet for other people to want to work there. Certainly Sean and Dave, who have worked for me for a long time, Sean not anymore, like we talked about, but were inspired by what she had accomplished when they got there over the seven, you know, for 7 years before they even showed up.
When you have Diner, when you have your one physical restaurant and Caroline is there and she's attracting quality young talent, when you decided to grow to 3-4 different locations and more, what type of infrastructure did you have to build in, both from your perspective, but also just, I mean, when you go from one restaurant to 2 to 3, you have to address the fact that you're now a bigger business.
Yes, so, for sure. We have had growing pains.
So can you talk about those growing pains how you, if you've been able to overcome them, and also some places where you haven't been so successful?
Sure. So one thing that we've done is we've grown slowly. Even though we certainly have a lot of businesses, we haven't grown that fast. Most of the time when we open new businesses, it is because the staff inside one of the businesses has grown to a place where they need the next challenge. So even when we opened at the hotel, we took Jason, Sean, I mean, Aaron Crowder, all these group of people who had worked for me for a really long time, and we kind of like duplicated, and they all went there, and then we repopulated at Diner and Marlowe.
Well, this is actually, you hire and then you promote from within.
Yes.
And by giving people upward mobility, they don't have to leave.
That's right.
But that is a rarity. That's very difficult to keep someone for even a year these days.
Yeah.
What are the specifics? Like what is the vibe that
what
you create?
Is the secret?
Yeah. How do you get people to stay?
I'm just kidding. I think the way we do it is that I orient my job towards them, right? So I feel like it's my job to be working for them in the same capacity that they're there to be working for the guests and or for the businesses. So my highest and top priority on a daily basis is like, is everyone happy? Is everyone doing a good job? And do they still want to be there? What makes them want to come to work, right? What makes them want to be there? I mean, part of buying Whole Cows was like, how do I inspire my team, right? Certainly, I had a whole litany of reasons why it was the best thing for us to do environmentally and health-wise and sourcing and all those things. But also, it inspired a whole lot of people to want to be there, right?
So what are the mechanisms for feedback that exist? Are there, you know, weekly and monthly meetings that you say, who's got a crazy idea? Let's talk about it.
So,
and then, you know, does someone come to you and say, I absolutely want to work on this project? And then is there a mechanism for trying to put those into place?
Yeah, you'd be surprised. Actually, there isn't that much that, as much as new businesses have bubbled inside of it, it's more bubbles like through talent and through like a longer idea. Very rarely does someone come and say like, oh, I really want to make donuts. Can you help me make donuts? Right? It's more like She-Wolf came out of, at Roman's, we really wanted to make our own bread. And so we hired a baker named Austin, and he came in, and then we were really impressed with the bread he was making. And then the other chefs in the company wanted that bread. And then we expanded through that process, right? So, and now it's obviously in Union Square and in farmers markets and everything else. But it wasn't out of this idea. Like, Austin wasn't working, like, inside the company and saying, hey, I really want to, like, run my own bread program, or I want to have my own bread business. So not really. There's not this, like, crazy idea. We're also, like, rooted in the fundamentals of our day-to-day and like rooted in like, you know, is the businesses working? So I think there's a lot of focus on where are we at right now and where do we want to take it versus like dreaming about wanting to like all of a sudden now make donuts, right? Because that idea of like wanting something, we don't try and chase the new, I guess is what I'm trying to say. We're sort of trying to chase success of what we do every day. And then what bubbles out of that is what is the next thing.
I ask a lot of guests of this show about how they manage their hours in the day. How do they manage their specific time that they allocate to the restaurant? You have many locations. I'm curious. I assume that there's no such thing as a normal day for you, but do you try to maintain a physical presence in all of them in some consistent way? You have a large family. Yeah. So I'm curious, do you wake up and say, like, I'm popping into 1, 2, and 3 today, or, you know?
So my day, the day part of my day is pretty structured. I definitely have very specific meetings with chefs and GMs and management teams and, like, CFOs and HR teams throughout the week, Monday through Thursday. And then I try and position myself in 1 or 2 of the restaurants 3 nights a week, give or take, sometimes 4, sometimes 2. And then if I'm not there, if it's, like, only 2, maybe that 3rd I would take someone on the team out to dinner or go see someone else or see something else. But normally 3 nights a week I am with staff in some capacity, either in the dining room or, you know, seeing something else.
How you mentioned, you know, HR, that come about after a certain number of locations, or did that start happening once you got in the hotel business and things really got a lot larger? When you open Reynard's, which is in the Wythe Hotel, located on Wythe in Williamsburg, that was a huge project. It was over $30 million, and it has a lot of various touch points, but the main is the restaurant on the main floor, and then there's a bar upstairs, but there's also an event space. So if you can talk a little bit about how different was that project from what you had previously done, and how did it come to be?
Yeah, I mean, that project, you know, I had so many close people who I had worked with for so long on that project in the opening team, and we also ended up bringing back probably 3 or 4, probably more actually, maybe 6 key staff who actually had left and come back and then worked there for 5 years with us. So in the end, there was a little bit of like a reunion tour for us in opening that restaurant. So, of course, the beginning was hard, like any opening, but there was a lot of joy that happened and a lot of, like, cultural components that got implanted into that building from what we had done before and, like, opening it new. The process of building it was long. You know, I mean, it was a long process. The banking crisis happened in the middle, so we took a pause. It kind of gave, I have 2 business partners in that whole business, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of really get to know them and meet them, which I think has been great and invaluable in terms of, like, our relationship together and how we run that business. But go back to your earlier question. I had HR prior to opening the hotel. I got very lucky. This woman, Leah Campbell, who started as an intern at the Diner Journal, then started working in my office, and then proceeded to create an HR department in our business. So it's another person who actually recently left, but had been there for 8 to 9 years, who basically created a full-on HR department for us and kept us very safe.
So you run Diner's Journal, which is a publication, and are the offices above Marlowe?
The offices are above Marlowe & Sons.
And tell me a little bit about how Diner's Journal came to exist and why, on top of, you know, running sustainably thoughtful restaurants and having a family and a hotel, why also has a publication factored into your lifestyle?
Yeah, Diner's Journal is actually on pause right now since we've just finished a cookbook. But the journal came out in a capacity that we thought that we had a different story to tell the world about food and about sourcing and about the people who were doing all of that work, and including, like, where were our inspirations and where were we thinking about in terms of food. At the time, this is, like, pre-phones, pre-blogs, pre-all of that stuff, so certainly it was an analog thing. I think now our voice in that is, you know, there's a lot of people who have found their voice in this story, and it's different than Sever or Bon App or even those guys and where their directions that they have taken it. So it originally popped out of an idea of, one, Caroline wanted to make a cookbook. we didn't know how to do that. We didn't have access to agents, and we were kind of had this DIY spirit, so we just did it ourselves. But it really came out of this idea of her wanting a book, but also us wanting to tell a different story about the food world.
And so I know it's on pause, but how long has it, how many publications have you done now?
I think we're at like 36, something like that.
And
we ran
it for... It's a quarterly?
It was quarterly. So mm-hmm. we did it for, I want to say 9 years.
And when's the cookbook coming out? And what's that?
The book is
out.
Okay. The cookbook is out. It's called Dinner at the Long Table. It's great. You should go get a copy. It's a beautiful book that came out in the fall. And I'm super proud of it. It's sort of a culmination of a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of food, in terms of how to serve a big group of people and how to like throw festive parties in your house. And it's sort of how to translate what has happened in the restaurant world outside of that world into home.
Your spaces are all different, but it could be said that you feel like you're in an Andrew Tarlow restaurant. There's a certain style of hospitality and also a certain style of food that's informed by the choices that you and your chefs and your teams make. I'm curious what you think about the whole fast casual explosion that's happening in food these days. It's not a space, as far as I know, that you're currently involved in. Is it something that you ever think about? Are your restaurants always going to be one-offs? Or I know you did have two Mexican spots,
right.
But I mean, like, you know, will there ever be a diner Shanghai? You know, will there ever be a Roman's London?
Tokyo. I mean, I would never say never, but I'm more interested in one-offs than I am in duplicates. And, you know, even the experience of opening a second Bonita was interesting because they had morphed a lot and changed quite radically. And the one in Fort Greene became a little bit fancier and we definitely had plated dishes and we sold a lot more entrees. Where obviously the one, well, not obviously, but the one in Williamsburg, we sold a lot more tacos and a lot more burritos and that type of thing. I really enjoy building and designing the restaurants, so I think I would continue down the one-off mark, one-off trend. I don't really have any interest in fast casual restaurants. I understand their purpose, but I don't really want to do that work. I'm probably a little bit late to the game anyway.
How do you do the design and build out of your restaurants? Do you do it yourself? Who do you help with the overall aesthetics? Like, how do you make the wood and material choices? Everything that goes into that. I'm curious, like, is that you and your wife that make those choices?
Yeah, or? I mean, I do that. Certainly, like, everybody on my team is a little bit involved. Certainly my wife is. But I've designed all the restaurants. I've been working with the same builder since building Diner. And this gentleman is obviously a close friend of mine. And he was one of the people who showed up on my couch in that loft back in the day before we built Diner. And ever since then, we've been working together. So I can still work off the back of a cocktail napkin with him. And when we know what we're talking
You're
about.
You're lucky you can trust your builder.
Yeah.
It's not something that a lot of people can say in New York. I want to know about Marlowe Goods. How did that come to be? And what are the projects that are coming out of that space now?
Yeah, super exciting. I mean, that is obviously an extension of thinking about the whole animal. And it's taken a long time for it to come to the fruition of where it is. But we source all the hides from the animals that we purchased through the butcher shop. And now we've extended past that and sourcing all hides specifically to either one farm or through one slaughterhouse that are still animals that are grass-fed and that are locally sourced. We just don't get enough cows now. She has a shop in the city in the East Village, and we sell designed leather bags and leather goods as well as clothing that's all organically sourced.
And do you also sell it at the store in Williamsburg?
We have a few items in the store in Williamsburg, a lot less. I mean, the items are expensive, so it's a little tricky to start talking about a $600 bag and how come that's, you know, we do have them there, but they definitely sell, there's definitely a better story inside of her own store where she can really control that conversation.
Communicate better with the people that come in and have that face-to-face.
People are buying a $4 coffee and then they're like, going to buy a $700 bag.
Yeah, it's not quite the impulse purchase that a croissant is.
Exactly.
I want to know a little bit about if you have any other projects on the horizon that you can talk about. And is there anything that's bubbling up right now?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that we're doing is going gratuity-free. So we've removed tips at Roman's and we've removed tips at Renard and Ides. And that is really a full-on, takeover of the restaurant in some capacity and a really rethinking of where our systems are and where our money goes. And we are working towards getting Diner, Marlowe & Sons, and Achilles Heel also gratuity-free. So that's really what my focus has been on.
Can you expand a little bit on the gratuity-free idea? I know you created a website that has some open source information about it, but why? What was the choice to go gratuity free, and also what does that mean for your staff?
Yeah, I mean, the big why obviously is to try and level the playing field between the back of the house and front of the house. You being a chef, you obviously understand that disparity. I mean, in 2017 now, it's really hard for someone who lives in New York to be paid below or at minimum wage and expect them to perform correctly. Again, it goes back to this caring about our employees and really thinking about what does it mean to have staff members come and try and do this job successfully and actually get paid to do it. That's really the big why. We also feel like we also really would like to be in a different kind of control of our front of the house staff. I think the idea that they can work for the tables versus working for the business is a big mental shift. And it allows us to kind of really, I mean, we already are the boss. Obviously, we handle all the benefits. We take care of all the checks. We do all that stuff. But now we really can actually be in control of the whole thing. And it allows us to give raises, right? A front of the house server could only really get a raise by working Saturday night versus working Tuesday night. Now we have staff members who have kids and who would like to work Monday day and Tuesday day. And in essence, from an hourly standpoint, they make the same amount of money on a Monday day than they do on a Saturday night. So it's a huge cultural change for us. And it's huge for us to like expand that through all those businesses.
In terms of those actual numbers, a Saturday versus a Monday and sort of what goes into that secret sauce, is it true that anyone can see the numbers if they ask any staff member?
Totally. So part of the way we have been successful since we do buy our food in a very specific way and now we pay our employees in a very unique way, it's important that the bottom line is really watched. So one of the ways we have figured out by how to do that is by sharing the numbers with the staff. Again, as I've said in many programs, not many people take us up on it, besides the people who kind of are mandated to do it, like GMs and managers. But in essence, I would like to bring everybody into the process of making that restaurant great and making the restaurant successful. And I don't need to exclude anyone from that.
Do you feel that by showing the numbers, it provides greater understanding to why you make the choices that you make? Is that the main, is it just transparency?
Transparency, but also I think it should allow people to make better decisions. Like, why are those forks constantly being bought and why do we need to, why are they getting thrown out and how can we figure that out? Versus like it just going into a black box that no one knows about.
What advice would you have for someone who's been working in the New York City food scene for some time and they're looking to do kind of what you did with Diner, join up with a friend and a partner and go out on their own? What's something that you maybe wish that you could redo that if you could talk to someone who's hoping to maybe strike out on their own for the first time, that you would give them a bit of advice in that capacity?
I would say the biggest one, if at all possible, buy the real estate. That's the biggest one.
A near impossibility in this day and age.
But if there was one thing that I wish, that would be the one wish, the one thing I would say someone should try and do at all costs.
You have, as we briefly touched on, you have a large, wonderful family, and you live in the city. Your wife has a business of her own that's associated with the restaurant. So I'm curious, is how do you turn off the restaurants if you do? If you don't, how does that kind of affect your life? And if you do, is it, you know, after 11 p.m., no calls from the restaurant unless there's a fire, you know? Yeah. How does that balance function or not function?
Yeah, obviously all my kids have grown up with me owning restaurants, so they're embedded into the sort of fabric of that day-to-day in a very real way. I think... I haven't tried to compartmentalize it. I have tried to more think of it all as one thing. I don't think the restaurants as being a noose or like an intense amount of work. Like, sure, I mean, for me as a manager, like, it's about me being organized in the capacity that I don't need to be there on Sunday, that I actually pay someone to be there on Sunday. And that falls on my skill set of what I can do as a leader and what my expectations are, right? So... But in the end, I think if, like, I worked this Friday night, I was totally happy to be there. And it happens, like, there was one of my managers out she was getting married, and a lot of the staff went to that wedding. So, and I actually said I wasn't going to go to the wedding, and I stayed back and worked. Like, that's totally fine, you know? I think people who try and create real boundaries, they end up getting crossed versus these lines that are a little bit more blurry. It just becomes an extension of what you do every day. Do you enjoy what you do every day? If you do, then it's not a big deal having to wake up at 8 o'clock and go to work, right? I don't know if that answers it, but I feel like I don't feel like it's like it's either this or it's that, right? It's all one thing.
Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Everybody, come tune in next week, Tuesdays at 11 a.m. for The Line here on Heritage Radio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.